Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, everyone. So maybe just up front, you won't find a lot of equations in here. I originally did my PhD in economics, but it's a long time ago and I've forgotten most of it. What I really tried to do, therefore, to bring some value to the presentation today is to try and give you a glimpse as to what are all the models used for and what are some of the decision problems that people have when they actually use risk return related information. As Tom mentioned in the introduction, algorithmics today is one of the largest financial software risk management companies in the world. We have largely two distinct customer groups. One are the classic financial institutions, banks, of which there are fewer and fewer, and the other ones are asset managers, insurance companies, hedge funds, corporates, a pretty diverse set of customers. So let me dive right into the presentation, and I hope I managed the multiple screens here. In the end, there are four points I wanted to get across. One is relating to the recent market events. To what extent should we have been surprised or not surprised? The next one is, what are some of the common fallacies or misconceptions around building risk and risk return related models? As a third point, I want to talk a little bit about the shorter term future, what I call the next wave here, but I also want to take a bit of a longer term outlook into where is this all going. So when we ask the question, well, should we have been surprised? The key points that we'll make are risks are interrelated and sudden shocks do happen. Lack of transparency always makes market failure worse. And finally, virtuous circles can rapidly reverse themselves. So here's a quote that I think describes pretty well what happened in the last year, 6 months, three months, pick your time horizon, in financial markets. Poor oversight, insufficient governance, lack of transparency, risks assessed incorrectly. Plenty of money in the interbank market, therefore there's no real need to worry about liquidity. And when liquidity is needed, because everybody wants it at the same time, it can disappear. The problem is that this is not a statement that was made by someone in the last couple of months. It's actually a statement that came out of an article in 2000 commenting on the Asian crisis in 1998. It's one of DBIS papers, if one of you is interested. And the paper goes on to basically talk about liquidity crises being increasingly common. It paints the picture of a probable potential collapse in the interbank market. And it uses Japan in the, I guess, mid to late 90s as an example where all of a sudden there were serious concerns about the credit quality of some of the Japanese banks. And while there was originally no price discrimination in LIBOR markets, all of a sudden LIBOR spreads for those banks diverged dramatically from what was the general LIBOR spread, which is again kind of what we are seeing in today's markets, where again, LIBOR and base rates are diverging as people are getting worried about the solvency of banks. What we also see is that some of the larger financial institutions, of course, have had serious problems, and some of them either went into a formal bankruptcy type situation or were bailed out. And again, the reasons are fairly common, and I don't want to bore you with a description of the usual case study histories that we see all over the press and so. But again, when you look at, you know, which institutions one might be referring to, I took those two examples out of a description that related to Continental Illinois in the late 80s and Superior Bank at around 2000-2001. So in other words, what we see now is maybe surprising to a younger generation. I'm not sure if I'm part of that or not anymore. But I'm not sure it's actually surprising in itself. For anyone that looks at history, that looks at various banking crises in the past, similar things have happened and probably will happen again. One interesting aspect, of course, is what happened to the virtuous circle of liquidity. And there's an interesting quote that one of the Federal Reserve governors made in 2007. The basic point here is that liquidity makes markets more complete, the more complete markets allow for the better pricing of various risks, which in turn enhances innovation and so on and so forth. What then happens is that, of course, at some stage, things don't work so well anymore, and there's some sort of a panic where all of a sudden money is in serious demand, but in very short supply. And this is about the oldest quote I can find, which is actually relating to a financial crisis in 1825. But again, it's pretty similar to what has been happening in the last little while. The very same Federal Reserve governor, a year later, told a very different story. And all of a sudden, what used to be the virtuous circle was rudely interrupted, as he put it quite well here. And we had the deleveraging of highly leveraged positions and so on and so forth. And of course, what happens is that there's a crisis of confidence, the price of risk increases, and liquidity disappears, which we again see as we watch LIBOR rates, TED spreads, whatever it is, through time, and we see the spikes in the cost of raising money. So this is an interesting book. I picked it more or less at random out of a library of similar books, and it's really more a historical book than a very quantitative book, but it was published originally in 96 or something like that, and I found the cover quote quite interesting. Well, basically, sometimes in the next 5 years, you may kick yourself for not reading and rereading this particular book. When you then proceed to look at the table of contents, and you look at the different themes that make up the table of contents, going back in financial history, I think they go back to the 16 or 1700s and the hundreds in the particular book, it's the same story over and over again. You could use this taxonomy of crisis points, of milestones in a financial crisis. You could apply it to 2007 and 2008. You could apply it to the internet bubble in 2001. The themes are very, very similar. I'll now shift topics a little bit, and I want to talk about some of the misperceptions, or the fallacies rather, in risk management and in building risk-related decision support models. And the point here is really that at the highest level, what I'm trying to say is that for the last 10 to 20 years, as I've grown up in a sense with financial risk management, we maybe gave a false sense of security where we focused on making models better, more complete, more detailed, and we in a way pretended that we described a physical reality that could be captured well in a particular model, rather than describing what are really, in the end, social phenomena that can be approximated, represented in a model, but a model is just a fairly crude guess as to what is really going on, and the guess is based on a lot of assumptions, and I don't think we as a profession have been forthright about the assumptions that we are making. So that's in essence the point that I'm trying to illustrate. The first point is a little bit inspired by what you hear when you're talking to various chief risk officers, consultants that advise chief risk officers to the board. There's always the value added of risk management, the wonders of risk-adjusted return on capital and similar concepts. And the implication is that by better measuring risk, we somehow create value for the shareholders, make regulators happy, and everybody's better off. I beg to disagree, actually, because I'll give you first an intuitive example, and I'll then give you a more detailed example. So here's the intuitive example. This is the Tier 1 capital ratio for Citibank over the last 5 or 6 quarters. And so regulatory capital, basically. And the point that you see here, in essence, says, well, risk capital did what it was supposed to do. Citi made some wrong investments, no doubt, but capital was sufficient to ensure that Citi continues as a going concern. There were contingency plans in place, money was raised, and in the end, there's sufficient regulatory capital to allow the ongoing business of the bank. Of course, if you look at the stock price over the same time horizon, then you see that shareholders during the same time got almost wiped out, and if you look at some of the other financial institutions, essentially got fully wiped out. So what worked well from a regulatory perspective, nobody that put money as a depositor in the city lost money, did not work at all for shareholders. We recently published a paper where we took that concept and we tried to formalize it a little bit more. And what we tried to do is, what you see, of course, two distributions of potential returns and losses, losses on the left, returns on the right. And what we're basically trying to say is we ran an optimization problem that in essence said maximize return subject to maintaining a minimum credit rating either at the AA level, single A level, triple B level, and so on and so forth. And find me the best possible portfolio of assets that respects my target credit rating and gives me the highest possible return given that credit rating. And if you look at it very casually, then the two distributions here, the two sets of distributions, I should say, look roughly similar. And then when you look a little bit more closely, you realize that the distribution to the left has this funny hump right here. And so where does this hump come from? Well, it turns out that what we've done on the left-hand side is we maximized possible potential return, or expected return, I should say, sorry. We maximized expected return subject to the constraint that I cannot lose more money than my target credit rating implies, which is somewhere right here. So the bondholder only loses if you lost more money than some number that's around here, but the bondholder doesn't care if you lose money that's close to the threshold. So basically, the portfolio that came out of the analysis has a very high risk in the medium to high level risk region, but has very low risk in the very, very high risk region where the bondholders would be affected. Conversely, on the right-hand side, we ran an optimization that said, yep, make sure the bondholder is okay, but in addition, also understand the risk tolerance of the equity holder. And we phrased it, forgot the details, but we phrased it somehow along the lines of the equity holder would not like to lose more than 2 years' earnings in a bad outcome. And when you do that, what happens, of course, is you kind of squish the distribution here, and you avoid those almost really big losses that that cause a lot of trouble here. The interesting thing is, when you look at the numbers a bit more in detail, you would see that a debt holder only optimization actually results in a higher expected return than a debt and equity holder optimization that tries to respect both constraints at the same time. So when people say, you know, I have my economic risk capital defined and I use it to report to the board, I use it for the regulator, I use it for the rating agency, and to proceed to have one number, then that's actually not very meaningful because different stakeholders require very different perspectives on what the relevant risk is. The economist phrased the same thing in a much kind of more intuitive way, where essentially leverage in the balance sheets, of course, looks great in good economic scenarios, but doesn't look so great, showing here the decline in the bank index over time when the economy turns. The second point I wanted to make is, I think, and I said it before in the intro, I think we often positioned risk management or risk measurement as this objective science. In my point, it is not. It has a lot of highly subjective assumptions built in, which traditionally we've kind of swept under the rug and not openly talked about. This is an example that I actually took out of Raghunatha's recent book. It's a fairly straightforward example, but I think it makes the point quite well, so bear with me. First question, would you take the following bet? I have a coin or something like that. I tell you it's 60-40 in your favor, and I'm going to tell you that I'm going to throw the coin 1,000 times. Would you bet 20 times your annual salary for a big payoff? Probably you would, because over a sample of 1,000, you're almost certain to win. Now, however, assume that there is a uncertainty, let's say a 15% uncertainty around the 60-40 estimate, and therefore it could be entirely possible that the underlying data actually truly indicated odds of 45 to 55. Well, in that case, there were 2,000 tries, sorry, 1,000 tries, of course you'd be almost certain to lose. If the odds were either 45-55 or 75-25, all within the uncertainty range, well, maybe you win, maybe you lose, it's kind of even. So you say, okay, that's a nice textbook example, why, what does it really mean? Well, look at some facts around models that people use in the industry. You can show that if you have a cap, if you have, you try to measure capital for a portfolio of 1,000 exposures, and all you have is 120 months of data, then the sheer estimation error that comes out of it is about 30%. Some people believe that you should use equity prices to calibrate credit correlations using some Merton type approach. Some other people religiously believe that CDSs are the right way to go. Well, they don't give you the same correlations. The difference is quite significant. We ran a study recently because as part of what we do for our clients, we also calibrate various portfolio credit risk models. And what we try to do is we try to bring the model back to certain macro factors. So you see the macro factors here, for example, Dow Jones regional indices, Dow Jones industrial, three-month T-bill rate, volatility index for the market, and so on and so forth, unemployment rate, GDP growth, macro factors like that. And we then said, well, let's see what the explanatory power of those macro factors is in the context of a equity asset value driven credit model versus a CDS model. And we are I'm showing here the relative importance of those factors in each model. And what you see is, in an asset value, equity value type context, it's basically the equity indices that really matter, which you can trivialize to the statement, it's no surprise that an equity index explains equity returns, because even though there's a lot of fancy math around it, in the end, that's all that you really do. If, on the other hand, you look at CDS spreads, they seem to capture a much wider range of risk factors, some of them interest rate related and so on and so forth. I have no idea which one is right, but I know that as a decision maker, I'd be really worried if I were basing significant decisions on portfolio diversification on one model and not the other. Which brings us back to the Rebonato example that I showed before. Gets even worse. I also maintain that valuations involve a lot of subjective judgments. So if you just look at the press releases that the International Accounting Standard Board published about 2 weeks ago, they've had a really busy time here. And without going, I don't want to bore you with the details of the press releases, but basically this image of somebody stuck in a swamp who's trying to dig himself out but just pulling up his own hair type of thing. And what the press release is all about is, well, maybe fair value isn't so good always, but we don't really want to say it. So what kind of sophisticated constructs can we come up with to reconcile a backtracking from fair value with the fact that officially we still fully support fair value? And so what it basically means is that instruments that were classified as subject to mark-to-market or mark-to-model, where liquidity has disappeared, can now be taken out of the mark-to-model, mark-to-market context and can be reclassified as held-to-maturity type instruments, which of course plays havoc with any type of P&L and risk numbers and so that one has modeled. Again, this is actually not new, because there's an interesting BIS paper out of 2006 where the authors in essence claim the Heisenberg uncertainty principle for the valuation of financial products, which basically means the sheer act of measuring defines what it is, the value of what it is that you actually measure. Think of the classic example when about 6 months ago, Merrill Lynch finally decided to sell, I forgot the number, let's say it was 12 billion or 20 billion, some ridiculous number like that, of CDOs at a market value of $0.22 on the dollar. Well, the rest of the industry, at least some place in the industry, were terrified, because all of a sudden that established a new benchmark that everybody else had to go by. Or take as another example that Market Partners, the company that publishes all the CDS spreads and has made billions of dollars doing that, is all of a sudden under a lot of criticism because it turns out that the CDS spreads that everybody is using are actually not so objective and not so balanced as they might have been. And add to that the fact that CDSs might, for political regulatory reasons, become exchange traded. Well, then again, what a credit spread means is very different. So anyways, the point is, accountants like to pretend that everything is an exact value. It doesn't. And I think unless or until we recognize that values aren't exact, that values are within ranges, we're not going to really get out of the current crisis. There are a lot of regulatory documents that kind of talk about all the new risk factors that have to be considered, and I just chose two quotes by example. It all smacks a little bit of specification by hindsight. Now it's a really good idea to change the incremental default charge to an incremental risk charge and add credit spreads, equity prices, et cetera, et cetera. But we only know that because we've lived through last year. Another problem is quite often validation is one of those wonderful words. Everybody will always ask you, have you validated your model? And you will say yes, yes, yes. And you will pray to God that you're not going to get audited because then you have to actually prove that you validated your model. And then you ask algorithmics, well, do you validate your models? We say, yes, we do, but it's your job to validate your model. It's not my job to do it. And so it goes, and lengthy letters are being written. About a year ago, there were a lot of articles in the press that talk about the failure of valued risk models. Investment banks would observe 16, 10, 15, 20 VAR exceptions in one quarter. And as most of you probably know, Basel has this traffic light system that, depending on the number of exceptions for valued risk, a valued risk model is deemed to be good, or if there are too many exceptions, not so good. What people forgot is that when you actually go back all the way to 1995, the specific reason that a valued risk model was supposed to be scaled by a factor of three or more, and this is quoted directly out of the original 1995 documents, is the past isn't a good predictor of the future. There are fat tails. Correlations may be wrong. It might be insufficient market liquidity, et cetera, et cetera. So if you actually, I should give some credit to Alex, who is here and helped me actually build this example. So if any one of you asks nasty questions, can actually pass it on to Alex. Anyways, the perspective here is if there are 16 exceptions in one quarter, you can actually show that if value at risk is multiplied by 3, which is the minimum multiplication factor, there is a 50% or higher probability that a 3 times value at risk has one exception or less. If you further assume that then actually there is one exception, just one, the probability of rejecting a correct model would be as high as 50%. So it's not so easy and it's not so simple, and it's easy to say a valued risk model has failed given the exceptions, but it comes back a little bit to what are you really trying to validate? Is what you're validating the exact model that you set out to build, in this case 12 years earlier? This is a kind of high-level quote that goes in the same direction. Validating a model for one purpose does not mean it's validated for another purpose. If I validate a model for pricing, I have not validated it for risk management. If I validate it for pricing and risk management, I have not validated it for economic capital management, which imposes quite a high level of due diligence that is needed to properly justify models. So those of you that travel a lot see these HSBC ads in all major airports. The point here I'm really trying to make is everybody now talks about risk management. I don't hear the word reward or return or upside that often. Yet when I recently talked to a CRO that's a client of ours, after the usual tales told about recent liquidity crises, he very quickly proceeded to saying, what we really worry about is not how we're gonna how much money we could lose tomorrow. We've been through that, we've quantified it, it's okay. What we worry about is, what are the opportunities that we're missing tomorrow because we are so focused on the downside that we forget to look at the upside. So those are some of the observations in the past. Let me now switch and talk a little bit about the future and some of the major implications. Fundamentally, again, risk management is about decision-making on uncertainty. Focus on the stakeholders is important. It's important we acknowledge uncertainty, we challenge assumptions. We are creative, and we understand that risk is more than one number. Basically, what it means is that when we focus on the stakeholders, remember my debt holder, equity holder example from before, it's really important that the level of risk tolerance comes all the way from the top of the organization and is tied in with what the board thinks, with what the owners think. In practice, that doesn't happen that often, because if you look at the latest Federal Reserve review, you see that economic capital models and risk management models are very non-aligned, for example. But nevertheless, we have to try and strive for really bringing the board and highest levels of management into establishing a risk tolerance. Different stakeholders require different confidence levels. There's a very interesting debate that's now taking place amongst U.S. regulators, which basically says by going after regulatory capital and by establishing minimum standards for regulatory capital and focusing on whether banks still meet regulatory capital, is this really what we're trying to achieve? Because the problem is a smaller loss that doesn't eat up all the set-aside capital already results in a loss of confidence, difficulties for the bank to raise new money, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, should we really focus much more on potential losses in the context of the capital buffers on top of the regulatory capital rather than the reg capital per se, which kind of flips the way that people should really think about what are the required capital levels. One of the things we developed in the last several years is, of course, a portfolio credit risk model. Then there was the whole Basel II debate around portfolio credit risk with an asymptotic single risk factor model, and a lot of very detailed discussions on what the exact correct or incorrect assumptions are. And again, the challenge is much more that I think that it's not so much the modeling assumptions, but it's really more the estimation errors, the inaccuracies in setting up the model that should give us pause for thought. And here is just one recent example that we did in one of our joint ventures with a German bank. We looked at emerging market correlations in relatively quiet times and then in times of trouble. And of course, what you see is that the correlations are dramatically different. Here, things are very highly correlated. Here, things are a little bit correlated, but overall not that highly. So you could, for example, say that in normal times, the Czech Republic has wonderful diversification effect compared to Brazil. In troubled times, it doesn't really, just as one example. Now, I think that a discussion around which correlations go into an economic capital model and what you're trying to prove, are you trying to look at short-term time horizons, are you trying to identify worst cases, are you trying to go into detail, is probably the most important discussion to be had in that context. But I can tell you from my experience, implementing risk solutions over and over again, in reality, nobody cares. This problem does not exist. Correlations come from some mythical land, feed into the model, are being used. Maybe there's a quant that quit 3 years ago that last defined what the model really is, and management makes decisions with an extremely limited understanding of what the assumptions down here are. So we have to challenge those assumptions. We have to recognize that depending on different assumptions, there might be different measures of risk, and we have to look at all of them together. Stress testing, imaginative stress testing is quite important, and I promised you would look at pictures more than formally, so I'm delivering them, I promise. But why did I choose some map from the 15th century or so? Because when you look at the world, you see some sort of mythical beasts, you see very rough shapes, some things don't make any sense at all. the state of risk management is not any more advanced than what you see here. And I think when we make decisions, we have to recognize that. We have to recognize that we need more than one number. And it is clear, and these are various supervisory groups that came together in early 2008 that concluded quite specifically that flexibility around assumptions, integration of risks, ability to alter assumptions are really important factors. Further, risk management has to be quite proactive, firm-wide, transparent, and part of the firm's governance. What do I mean here? First, as we talked already a bit about before, methodology in itself can convey a false sense of precision. The model looks very precise, and that's good, and that's important, but it distracts from what went into the model. Well, this comes back to the good old garbage in, garbage out in some sense. And again, there is a regulatory recognition that firms that applied risk at a risk models mechanically didn't do so well compared to firms that really challenged assumptions. That it is very important to be able to pull together counterparty exposures to asset classes within a matter of hours, which today banks can't really do, even after many years of investment. It's important to bring together information from many parts of the business. That it's important to not get hung up in silos. It is not good enough to let each business unit manage risks left to its own devices. You have to bring it together, and you have to slice and dice it in different ways. The other thing is, and this goes almost back to the days when I was in university, every 4 or 5 years, people talk about Bayes again, and all of a sudden Bayesian economics kind of, probabilities kind of have a comeback. And yet again, lo and behold, you look at the latest regulatory presentations, and all of a sudden the OCC and the Fed are wondering whether it's time to revisit Bayes. In the context of how do you combine a quantitative approach, which we need, with judgment and expert opinions, which we also need, because we didn't really have it in the last 1 or 2 years, and we see the mess that happened. So therefore, how do we bring those two streams together? And maybe there's an answer in some of the ideas in a Bayesian type of approach. Of course, it's important to bring many different risk factors together. I don't want to comment on that in too much detail. But I also think that we need to take a new look at transparency. And transparency is one of those buzzwords. It's hard to argue against transparency, but of course the question is, what does it really mean? Now, just give you one example. So the Basel Committee recently recommended that banks establish procedures for adjusting current valuations in view of liquidity risk, which, by the way, in itself is really messy because it means that the Basel P&L is no longer identical to the trading P&L, and all of a sudden there's another set of P&Ls that people have to carry. But leaving aside that minor complexity, I'll give you an example to make the whole thing a bit more meaningful. So this is one of the financial institutions in the U.S., and what I'm showing you is the credit value adjustments of that institution over the last 5 quarters as a percentage of the total P&L. So for example, what you see is that in the most recent quarter, 30% of the P&L is negatively impacted by monoline related credit value adjustments, which basically means in practice that that bank had a lot of structured products that were guaranteed by monoline insurers. The monoline insurers aren't doing so well, so the credit quality declines, so the value of their insurance declines. At the same time, what was really helpful to a lot of financial institutions is because you mark to market your own liabilities, as your credit quality declines, and therefore the spread on your liabilities increases, you have a P&L gain. So it came in very, very handy that roughly the mark-to-market impact on the liabilities, the positive mark-to-market impact on the liabilities, kind of offset the negative mark-to-market impact of the credit value adjustments on the assets. And that's fine, and that's intended, and that's one of the few areas where the accounting regime actually seems fairly balanced between assets and liabilities. The problem is, I'm not sure whether many of you have looked at CVA type of models in your studies, but the number of assumptions that go into calculating a credit value adjustment for a trading book are enormous. You need to estimate potential future exposures, which means you have to have some sort of an underlying model that projects interest rates and exposures 3, 5, 10 years into the future. You need to assume PDs and LGDs. They can come from many places with many different numbers. You need to make a fundamental decision. Do you use market prices, CDS spreads, or do you use some internal benchmark price to then define the price or the cost of credit? You need to make a decision on, I don't want to get lost in details, but to be technically correct, you cannot do it on a transaction by transaction basis, but you need to do what the industry has called portfolio referencing variable notional credit spreads or something like that. Sorry, I forgot the exact name, but the point is, if you're long and short with the same counterparty and you net it out, then the net credit adjustment is very different than if you treat each transaction separately. It is, if you really think about what you have to do to net it out, it comes down to a simulation within a simulation within a simulation type of modeling approach, which you probably need some nuclear power plant to actually fire up all the CPUs to actually run the valuation. I mean, I know of one bank that this year bought 8,000 CPUs in addition to the 8,000 they had, and they're not doing CVAs yet. So what is behind those assumptions? And why accountants are so confident that these are the exact numbers, I don't know. And there are a lot of questions to be asked. I come back to the theme of governance, where it's really important that the board understands the risks and also gives an indication of risk tolerance. And again, based on my limited experience, that is not the case today. It just isn't. However, I think that we can develop tools to properly tie in, and this is an example from one of our European clients who recently developed a fairly detailed methodology of how essentially the board of directors, the executive, and the risk management group is involved in all the various different steps of how do you define scenarios, how do you calibrate the underlying models, how do you interpret the output, and it's a fairly intense process, and those are some very good steps in the right direction. I talked already before about the importance of managing risk and reward together, and again, in analogy to the HSBC ad campaign that I referenced before, whether you see risk or reward in a particular distribution of risks and returns really depends on your perspective. And if in risk management, we are not clear on what the objective is and who am I really working for? Am I working for the board? Am I working for the regulator? Am I working for the rating agency? If I can't clearly answer that question, I actually don't know what I should measure. If I don't know what I should measure, I don't know what I'm commenting on risks or what I'm commenting on rewards. The last couple of points I wanted to make relate to innovation, and maybe what I didn't write down, but what I strongly believe, is innovation will come back. Yes, there are lots of statements now that structured products are wrong and people shouldn't go into fancy products and retail investors will never ever buy structured products. I think that is a shooting from the hip type of response. I think that the way people will buy products will change. I think that the way we have to explain risks will change. But structured products, innovation in finance, has as many advantages as disadvantages, and it's more about how do we crystallize those advantages and how do we put in the lessons learned rather than now shying away from the whole area. And the way maybe to summarize this is that in the past, when financial products were distributed, it was often based on a fundamental assumption of trust. It has a AA credit rating, therefore it must be good. What was in it and how the financial firm or the rating agency established the credit rating didn't really matter too much. People bought it given the stamp of approval. I think that in the near-term future, the way things will go probably is that there has to be much more transparency around the risks that these products have, and transparency has to be expressed in fairly straightforward ways. And again, there's some encouraging signs. So for example, in Europe, you have MiFID, and MiFID for financial structured financial products as a EU directive actually implies that you have to look at ratios, for example, in the expected case, how many years is it going to take me to earn back the premium that I paid for the product? Or in the 99% worst case, 2 years from now, what is my worst case loss? So all of a sudden, those types of stress scenarios and ratios are being requested and to help provide transparency. I think the longer term, what's going to happen is that that financial products will be much more focused on the specific needs of specific clients, and the client and the financial firm will work together in a transparent environment, looking at all the different stress scenarios to come up with the optimal structure. And this is a trend that we see today some of our recent clients are much more focused on private wealth management and how do you explain sound investment strategies in the private wealth space, and how do you tie in structure products that make sense than a compliance-oriented risk management. And looking at the level of sophistication that is now being applied there with various optimization routines, with fairly sophisticated ways to extract the risk return profit preferences of the retail investor. So I see a lot of good and encouraging trends there that I think will reestablish to some extent the reputation of the industry. So maybe just in closing, what are they really trying to communicate today? Well, first, the lesson from history is really black swans have happened and will happen. And we shouldn't act surprised when they do happen. I think it's really important to be very clear on understanding who the stakeholders are for a risk management function and what the risk appetite is, what the risk tolerance is. And it's important to analyze risk at a firm-wide basis, to focus on the major risks, to not get lost in detail, but to focus on what could really make or break the firm. And to do that quite holistically, meaning be creative about the different scenarios that are being applied and think outside the box. I think it's important to challenge assumptions. I talked a lot about the assumptions that are implied in models that need to be drawn out, that need to be made very explicit, and where we as modelers, as the industry, owe it to explain to the consumers of information what are all the assumptions that we made in coming up with the number. It's important to offer full transparency and to go way beyond what is presented as transparent today, and to acknowledge uncertainties, which might be, I have to tell you one last anecdote. So one of our clients, on top of managing the day-to-day crisis, had the Federal Reserve in for one of their reviews. And which is of course a real pain, because basically you spend your whole day doing your stressful daytime job, and then you spend another day, which is the night, producing all the ad hoc reports that the regulator wants to see. And so his comment was, it's quite interesting. When you talk to medium-level people in the regulatory space, then they will ask you a lot about, have you properly validated your model? Do you really understand your model, et cetera? And they expect answers, yes, I have, yes, I do. If you talk to the more senior people, and you say, yes, I have, yes, I do, the answer you get is, you must be lying to me, because nobody does, and nobody has. To tell you another anecdote, still have time for one more anecdote here. So I was recently in Mexico visiting a subsidiary of a global financial institution that's also a local client in Mexico. And the same story. The regulator has been in. I'm not going to tell you whether it's a European regulator or North American regulator, because otherwise you know which institution I'm talking about. And so the guy that I met, who is the chief risk officer of the local bank, you know, kind of met me for 20 minutes, but was clearly stressed out, and I kind of saw that it was time to leave the office and let him get back to work and so. But nevertheless, he told me, Michael, this is actually really interesting, because So I go through the motions. I show, you know, we do this, we do that, it's all wonderful. And we're in really good shape in risk management, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, at the end of the day, the real question is, and keep in your mind that Mexico actually has pretty good macroeconomic and financial market fundamentals. The political question is, as North American or European financial institutions need capital infusions, there's a clear tug of war between the local regulator and the North American or European regulator as to, can you actually take the money out of Mexico and can you put it into the head office balance sheet to shore up the balance of the head office. So at the end of the day, that question is much, much more important than the details of how does risk management locally really work. And I guess that actually in itself, that anecdote illustrates another assumption. Nobody at ALGO, nobody in the industry that I know of, other than maybe in the insurance sector, which is a different situation, would have assumed that when you come up with an enterprise risk number, the capital that you put against it is not highly fungible. Because what happens now is that in times of crises, each particular national regulator basically says, no, I'm gonna basically keep the money for a local crisis, but I'm not willing to cross-subsidize something else. The classic example, of course, again, is Iceland, as a different example where the Icelandic government, who is as broke as one can be, made it very clear that the deposit insurance that Icelandic banks have does not cover depositors that gave the money to the Icelandic banks in England, by the way, in Canada, in Saskatchewan, and in various other jurisdictions. And it led to a pretty ugly diplomatic row, actually, between the UK and the Icelandic government, and then in the end it was kind of patched up. But again, these issues of risk capital, where does it come from? Are my assumptions around the availability of capital actually sound or not? That's also a pretty serious issue that I think we in the industry have underestimated and we should pay more attention to. And finally, we have to enable proactive decisions on reward as much as on risk. It's not just about the risk side, it's equally about the reward side. So that's what I wanted to cover today. Really appreciate the invitation. Thank you, and we probably have time for one or two quick questions before we break. I think the most important positive signal is actually implied in the question that you asked, which is humility. Because I think the biggest, it's an attitude change more than anything else. I think everybody always wants to do a great job in our professional lives. So you never want to be in a position where you say, here is my risk assessment, and by the way, here's the list of things where I had to make pretty rough and ready assumptions. You kind of try to leave that to the last page. And so. And I think more humility around those assumptions, making people more aware as to what are the key driving assumptions is a really important starting point. I think the second point is that I think what the way I called it here in the presentation is risk is more than one number or so, and I think any attempt to oversimplify and to say here is the magic valued risk number that tells me all I need to know is plainly not going to work too well. And we have to go to the next level of detail where we look at gross exposures rather than net exposures, very simplistically speaking, and which is fine in itself. And I think the challenge then is that leads to huge communication challenges, because very quickly you then talk about things at a fair level of detail and you need to educate the audience. And I think maybe the other kind of what can we do to change things is we have to go through that education process. And it is extremely important. It is painful, it is slow. you have to educate over and over and over again, but things change. I mean, to give you another positive example, approximately four or five years ago, the European insurance industry was in pretty bad shape. Essentially, everybody was seriously undercapitalized, mostly because the actuarial models didn't properly capture the financial market risks that people were increasingly taking. And we tried to sell to those insurance companies in those days, and it was a dialogue between people that spoke different languages, different cultures, and we didn't get very far. We got to see some nice places in Europe, but we didn't get very far in terms of selling anything. 5 years later, all of a sudden, the insurance industry is one of the most important client segments that we have. But why? Because all of a sudden, when you look at the CRO forum, for example, which has the CROs of the top 10 or 15 European insurance companies, and you look at the backgrounds of those people, about at least half of them now have a varied capital markets insurance background rather than the pure insurance background. And so therefore they can apply modern finance, modern risk management concepts. And in 5 years, the level of understanding in that market segment about what the tools of modern finance-based risk management are have changed completely. So I think it's the old story. When you measure progress in weeks or months, it's kind of disappointing and discouraging. But when you look at what can we achieve in 2 or 3 years' time frame, it probably gets a bit better.
Last question, Mike.